Okay, Alan, it should be just you and me.
I can hear you.
Okay, and I can hear you. Everybody should be able to hear us fine. So, welcome, everyone, to the teleclass on value pricing with Alan Weiss. Let me tell you a little bit about Alan. Alan is one of the foremost management consultants and business speakers in the world. Not just the U.S., in the world. He's the author of 25 books, hundreds of articles, a leader of workshops, and innumerable teleclasses. He's consulted with organizations large and small, and has helped a lot of consultants like myself be more effective consultants and earn more through his concept of value pricing. And Alan really embodies the principles of what I call info guru marketing. He is an info guru. He puts that information out, and he is an expert. So I invited Alan to do this teleclass with me because I know the majority of independent professionals tend to undervalue themselves. I hear it over and over and over again. Not only do we struggle just to attract clients in the first place, but once we get them, we don't charge enough and don't make what we're worth. So, Alan, let me start with this question. Why do independent professionals tend to charge less than what they're worth? And what are they doing wrong, and what do they need to start doing differently? I suppose you could build your whole talk on those few questions.
Well, actually, there's sort of a philosophic reason, and there's a pragmatic reason. The philosophic reason is that most independent professionals don't have the proper self-esteem. When I first started mentoring people in 1996, and I've since mentored almost 600 people in that program, I used to think that people were undercapitalized. That was their major problem. I was completely wrong. You know, I'm constantly surprised at how stupid I was 2 weeks ago. What actually happens is that people don't have the self-esteem to stand toe-to-toe with a buyer and quote a price that reflects what their contribution is to the project. So that leads me to the pragmatic problem. And the pragmatic problem is that you need to deal with people who can write checks. That is, everybody on this line needs three things. They need to have a value proposition. That is, how is the client better off after they walk away? Second, an idea of who can write a check for that. And thirdly, the ability to reach those people. And those people are never, virtually never, in the human resources department or the training department. They are line managers. Now, if you're dealing with GE, you're not dealing with the CEO. You're not dealing with Immelt or Jack Welch before him. There are hundreds of buyers in GE, but you have to be dealing with somebody who can write a check for your value.
So, Alan, can we back up to the first one before we get into getting into companies, et cetera, the whole issue of self-esteem? Okay, you have independent professional A. He's experienced. He's gone to school. When he does get clients, he delivers great value. But as you say, he doesn't have the self-esteem. He doesn't feel he's worth it. What things have you found? I know this is not the easiest question in the world, to help people increase their self-esteem, or at least the realization that they are worth more than they're charging.
The business that you and I and everybody on this call are in is about intellectual firepower.
Right.
The mistake the consultants make is they get better and better at their own methodology. Nobody cares. Mm-hmm. I don't care about your 6 steps to sales perfection. I don't care about your 5 steps in strategic modeling. And please, if you're using, you know, SWOT analysis and things like that, you know, don't come near me. The fact of the matter is it's about intellectual firepower. That means you have to use the language correctly. That means that you have to be widely read. That means that you have to have the intellectual wherewithal to understand the kinds of situations you'll be in and interact to them. And just to give you even more of a specific, there is no objection we haven't heard. If you've been in this business for more than 8 months, there is no objection we haven't heard. There's no time, there's no money, you're too far away, your firm is too small. We know it all. So if you are not prepared to deal with those objections properly, then you are negligent and you don't deserve the business.
Yeah, and so there, right? So,
well, come on. I mean, the good thing about this profession is we control most of the sales process, yet people in the profession act as though they control 5% of the sales process and they're at somebody else's mercy. That's not the way it is. The dynamic is exactly the opposite.
So we take kind of an order-taker attitude, like, here I am, what do you need, and hopefully I can sell it to you, which just isn't enough.
Well, what it is we have to be able to reject acceptance and accept rejection.
Explain that.
Well, I mean this. This business is about rejection. Not every buyer buys, of course. And so, you know, I've been thrown out of better rooms than this one.
Right.
You show up, you do the best you can, and you leave. You know, it's like these crazy speakers who, if they don't get a solid 10 on their feedback forms, they fall apart. You know, for goodness sakes, you show up, you do the best you can, you leave. So you have to accept rejection. But You also have to reject acceptance, and that means that you cannot spend time with low-level people who can say no and can't say yes. Just this morning, somebody in my mentor program writes me and says, I'm having trouble with this person. I can't get the proposal submitted. Of course not, because they're not dealing with a buyer. And so you have to be absolutely mercenary about this. People at lower levels who cannot buy really can't help you. You can just use them as a stepping stone to get to the buyer. But you must interact with buyers as a peer. And if you feel unworthy in doing that, then you should get a job delivering for some other consulting firm, because you won't be able to market.
Right. So, Alan, on this call we have lots of coaches, personal and professional coaches, other independent professionals, plus consultants. And in the promotion for this teleclass, I gave the story of Patrick Summer, who is an executive coach, works with mostly small business owners, one-person businesses. He doesn't have a problem, and most coaches don't have a huge problem necessarily connecting with and selling someone. The point is that they sell way, way under what's possible. Most coaches will charge something between $300-$500 a month.
Holy God.
And that's not unusual. That's
Hold on, I have to reach for a martini.
That's the pretty much going rate. Well, Patrick does the same thing, maybe adds some value, and he definitely has the self-esteem. Patrick charges $1,500 a month for four meetings, and he just got his first $3,000 client. So he's making very good money doing very similar things to someone that's making, you know, 20, 30, 40% of what he's making. So the question is, you know, you're in there, you're talking to the right person, you've got the intellectual capital, and still we tend to not ask enough. How do you really know what to ask for?
Okay, hold on.
I mean,
Hold on. First of all, you know, to coach an executive, let's say the president of a division, I charge about $35,000.
Yep.
So he's not
over
making,
what period?
He's 30 days.
$35,000.
But it's not based on the month.
Exactly.
You understand? And so Patrick there, your example, is not making very good money. Maybe
well,
relative
he's working
to
with
else.
He's not working with big companies. He's
Let
working with individuals, et
Let
cetera.
Me finish.
Go ahead.
Okay. I just want to put things in perspective.
Yes.
I want to, you know, I'm here to provoke people.
Okay? Very.
So here's the answer to your question. Most coaches cite what they do. They cite their task rather than the result.
Right.
So in other words, if you're helping someone to become better organized, that's not really the result you're providing. The result you're providing them with is more discretionary time. There's a huge difference between those two things. If you're coaching someone to make better presentations, that's not the value of what you do. The value of what you're doing is to be able to influence people to sell more, or influence people to support the corporate strategy, or influence the media to report favorably on your company. So the real answer to your question is this. You have to start with the client's objectives, with the coaching client's objectives, and work backwards. You don't start with what you do to the client. You start with how the client will be better off.
Exactly.
That's always worth a fortune.
Yeah, and so your job in talking to someone initially is to find out about those objectives. Tell a bit more about how you dig in and discover those objectives.
Sure. Do you want me to focus on coaching or consulting in general?
It could be both. You know, it's a wide range of the people on the call. So there's
a
lot of consultants.
I'll just
there's
say
a lot
consulting
of coaches.
Because coaching is really a subset of consulting, not the other way around.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. So if you're talking to a buyer, and that's always the caveat, you have to be talking to a buyer. What you say is something like this. What are the end results that would tell you this project is successful? What are the improvements or changes or recoveries that will show that this has been worthwhile for you? What would your environment look like? What would your customers look like? What would your employees look like? How would you personally feel? Because behind every corporate objective is a personal objective. You know, if somebody says to you, I want to increase our retention rate of new hires, what they're really saying is they're tired of doing so much interviewing. So those are the questions you ask to get objectives out. The second set of questions you ask.
Alan, sub-question to that. How much time in that interview are you asking the objective questions?
If you have a trusting relationship with the buyer, and a trusting relationship might be developed in 20 minutes or three meetings. It depends on the interaction. But once you have a trusting relationship with the buyer, you can get those questions answered in 15 minutes.
Okay.
That's why when people do things like needs analysis and all this kind of stuff, I tell them they're crazy. Because if you have a buyer in front of you, with a trusting relationship, that's all you need. The second set of questions.
Because they know what hurts and they know what they want if you dig in.
Well, yeah, because you become your own worst enemy. You go down the hall interviewing people who don't matter. All you need is a buyer who can write a check.
Right.
The second set of questions revolves around metrics. And you say, if these are the objectives, how will you know we're making progress toward them? What indicators will tell you that we're getting there? What will tell you we're successful? So now the client stipulates measures of success so this thing doesn't become just a guessing game. And by the way, the objectives, the first set of questions, prevent scope creep because now you know exactly what the thing looks like to, as a finished product. And then the final set of questions, which is the real nuance and the thing I pioneered, you know, with Million Dollar Consulting in the early 90s, is you ask what the value is to the client. Because once the client stipulates the value, now fees become academic. And value isn't always in dollars. I mean, value can be in terms of aesthetics or less stress or better repute, or it could be in higher sales and better market share. But you say to the client, if we meet those objectives as measured by these indicators, what does that mean for you? What's the impact on your company? What's the impact on you? How will you be in a better position here? And now you've got a very dramatic kind of project where you're simply assessing a fee that reflects your contribution to that client's improvement.
What do you do when you get vague answers to that question? Well, I don't know. You know, we do want to increase sales, and, you know, how do you dig into that?
Well, you don't let them off the hook. That's all this. That's part of the self-esteem and peer dealing that I talk about. So you say, well, wait a minute. You're not seriously going to go about this project not really certain of what you want to accomplish.
Are so you? Right.
So when you say you want to improve teamwork, and I ask you, what would that look like? You can't say, well, I know it if I see it. You know, that's the Supreme Court definition of pornography, but it doesn't work for me. And so what you say is, yeah, but how will you see it? Now, let's say the client's still vague. You say, well, let me ask you this. There's some reason you're bringing me in right now. There's some reason you don't feel the teamwork's very good. And then the client says, well, as a matter of fact, the reason I brought you in is I'm tired of playing referee. Ah, so if you didn't have to play referee among the teams, that would be an indicator of success. And that's how you do it.
Let me go back to this question about metrics. One thing so many consultants say is, well, we go in, we do this, we do that, but we really can't measure what we do. Is that just a complete cop-out?
Of course it is. It's crap. The training the training community, if you read Training Magazine or Training or any of those things,
yep.
You know, they've been talking about this loopy thing that Kirkpatrick developed, you know, 20 years ago, four levels of measurement. They're ridiculous. The only kind of measurement that makes sense is results. And if you can't sit down with a buyer and determine how to measure results, you don't belong in the profession. And, you know, you wouldn't be able to walk into to Bain or Boston Consulting or McKinsey or any of these firms and not know how to get results for a client, and it's not rocket science.
Yeah.
So give me
some examples of metrics in a company that that you might be going after, real specific things.
Well, it depends on the objectives.
Okay.
But metrics could be sales increase. They could be increases in retention.
Okay.
They could be decreases in attrition. It could be increase in market share. It could be increase in repute. It could be an increase in the buyer's comfort level. It could, if you're coaching, it could be...
So you can have a metric that's somewhat intangible, not dollar-based.
The key is how you know it if you trip over it. This is Bob Mager's famous question.
Yeah.
How would you know it if you tripped over it? And so as long as you're dealing, now for coaches, this is particularly easy because you're dealing with one-on-one here and not a large unit.
Yep.
What you're asking is, how would you know you're more comfortable in front of the group? And the answer is something like this. When I'm asked a question, I won't panic. I'll be able to think for a minute, give them a responsible answer with an example. That's fine. That's easy to measure.
Yeah, and right now they can't do that. They sit there and they can't think on their feet and they're sweating buckets.
Right.
Or so they can really see the contrast there.
How would you know that you use more humor in an organization? I'll be able to tell some real stories from my background and the company's background that will obviously and demonstrably lighten the audience up, enable them to laugh a little bit. You can measure that. You can see it.
Yeah. Okay, very good. So... let's talk a bit about relationships. You talk about focusing on long-term relationships, not just the transaction. The fact that you're getting a client now, but you're looking at more than just closing this deal. How do you look at all of that?
Well, I call it thinking of the fourth sale first, and I've written extensively about this. And just so everybody knows, there's over 100 free articles and checklists on my website, summitconsulting.com. And so you can download these to your heart's content. Because I talk fast, but you can read all about this at great length. But basically, since it's so much easier to get repeat business from a client than to bring on a new client,
right.
You should look at any client as a long-term relationship. And what you should be thinking about, just as an example, Robert, to answer your question, make sure that the prospect, the buyer, understands the full array of services you can provide. Don't let yourself be pigeonholed as a singular entity, as somebody who can just do this and not that. So make sure that you don't start to talk about methodology or label yourself or talk about technology or approaches too soon that puts the conversation into too narrow a niche.
So I worked with a coach for about a year. He had an interesting process. He said, Robert, I can work with you month by month at X dollars, but for a few less dollars, we can do a year-long contract. So I looked at that, it made sense, and I did it for a year. So he packaged things for the long term. Can you talk about how you do that, or do you do that with your clients?
Well,
selling a bigger, more comprehensive thing, you know, at a value price?
Well, let me separate out two things.
Okay.
I run a mentor program, and that's for professionals in the business, and that's $3,500, and it's 6 months, and that's what I do to repay the profession. And that number comes from the original lease on my Ferrari. You know, it was $3,500 a month, and that's what I do.
So that's how he sets prices.
Yeah, my wife said, you must have gone to great market, you know, research lengths to do this. You know, I figured 12 people pays for the car.
Well, so, I'll get back into...
But that's the mentor program.
Yep.
But let's talk about the true coaching I've done with executives, and because that's really what you're talking about. And what I tend to do is to view these things more like retainers rather than coaching assignments. And so what I'll take a look at is, in other words, if I'm using the exact same coaching methodology on someone on the front line who manages 10 people and has a $200,000 budget, and I use that same methodology with an executive vice president who's responsible for $20 million and has 400 people, I will charge a heck of a lot more for that second person, even though my methodology is the same, because the impact I'm creating on that organization is far higher.
Right.
And never forget that the buyers have egos. I mean, when I quote a $35,000 figure to coach a vice president or an executive vice president, and somebody says, my God, we've never paid that before, my reaction is, what's your point? I mean, do you really want to pay $5,000 to the guy who's coaching the frontline supervisors and think that same person can coach your executive vice president? It's preposterous.
Yeah.
So your
price puts you in a whole different niche or category anyway. And
buyers believe they get what they pay for.
Yes.
Buyers have egos. And no buyer ever said... And Robert, this is maybe the salient point here. No buyer ever said, hey, look at me, I got the cheapest coach I could find.
Yeah.
You know what they say? I got a coach so expensive it hurts. This coach had to break two appointments to be with me, and I'm proud of it. That's how people talk.
Yeah, interesting.
And so,
there's probably very, very few people in this call that think that way. They think, oh, my God. Are they going to be able to afford me? People's focus is completely opposite.
You're
to
exactly
that.
Right. My approach seems counterintuitive, but really it's the only logical approach. The other approaches will take you to the poorhouse. And the problem here is that there's always money. In other words, I don't care if you're working with a small business, medium, large business. I don't care if they tell you there's no budget. There's always money. The real question isn't whether there's money. The question is only this. What's the priority? Because what you have to do is convince them the priority is to move the money that already exists to you. So there's no such thing as no money, but there is such a thing as you being too low a priority. And you're too low a priority when you haven't manifest enough value for the buyer.
Right. So you're discussing the objectives and the needs and the metrics, et cetera, and it gets down to closing. And they come up with, well, holy cow, that's a heck of a lot of money. And then you say, you're thinking, well, what's the point? But they feel they can't afford you right now. Are you saying that it's never the money, it's just their perception of value?
Of course.
And then, but you as the seller, you as the consultant, you're probably buying into it, right? You're saying, oh, they can't afford it. Maybe I should come down. You know, we look at completely in the wrong direction again,
well,
right?
In the first place, whenever you provide a proposal to someone, you should provide options. And psychologically, that takes it from should I use Robert to how should I use Robert, which ups your chances of acceptance by about 50%. So always provide options.
But you call it a choice of yeses.
Choice of yeses.
Yep.
But number two, if even your least expensive option they say is too expensive, then what you really haven't demonstrated is return on investment. And that's your fault.
Yeah, so they say a big price at the end, and they can't really justify that with the value of the objectives, the measurement that you've talked about.
That's right.
So it just doesn't make sense.
So you have to do a better job of that.
Yeah, so the price that you're sticking on your proposal is not an arbitrary figure. So you've really done some thinking about what this is worth.
Of course.
I mean, really objectively. Okay, they will, in the course of a year, net $1 million more, very likely, if I do my work. Are you thinking in that way?
Yes, or take something that's not as translatable to dollars. Because of their improved ability to influence an audience, whether at a small meeting or a large company affair, they'll be able to galvanize support for their initiatives much better. That's worth a fortune, too.
Right. Now, one thing that I always, one of your points that I always found very valuable is when people say, we cannot do it for X dollars, we could do it for Y dollars, which is 20-30% less, whatever, the average coach or consultant will say, okay, well, your first time client, and hopefully we'll get more work from you, so why not? I mean, is that pretty rampant?
Well, it is rampant because it's the self-esteem thing again. You see, once you lower your fee, the only thing the client can conclude is how low will she go? How low will he go?
Right.
I can name that tune in two notes. And so if you lower fee without lowering value, then you've proven that your fee is padded or that you're easy. And so,
Or both.
And the fact of the matter is, you have to be prepared to turn on your heel and walk away. And if you're really prepared to walk away from business, you'll wind up getting business at your fee. But once you keep collapsing on fee, you really have no business integrity because you don't believe you're worth it.
Yeah. But the one thing that you can do, you said, if they lower price, you have to decrease value. And
yeah, so for example, if they say, look, we love it, but it's too expensive, you say, well, I'll tell you what. I'll do you, you know, I'll coach you and your two subordinates, but I won't coach their four subordinates. We'll take that out. Or you say, I'll do the domestic operation for you in terms of this market study, but not the international. I mean, clients love to reduce fee, but they hate to reduce value. So you have to take value out. Now, and commensurate.
So sometimes they'll say, okay, that's fine, but hey, they see they're losing value and they go, well, wait a minute, right?
Well, they should.
Yes.
And but commensurate with that, you have to have fees high enough so that you do have the ability to take value out and lower a fee. If you're talking about $3,500, this whole discussion is academic.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. But if it's a heck of a lot more, it's a different situation.
Well, yeah, if you're charging $20,000 and $30,000 and $100,000 and $200,000 for your work, you have room. If you're charging $2,500, $3,500 for your work, you have no room.
Right.
And the thing is, this is a $10 trillion economy. Post Katrina, post 9/11, post everything else, the United States alone is a $10 trillion economy. And for those of you on this call from other parts of the world, I just came back from Australia where I did my $1 million consulting college. I've been to 54 countries. Most economies are in pretty darn good shape, relatively speaking. And so it's not the fact there's no money around. We have to be able to ask for it.
So what's in the mind of that buyer when they're looking for a consultant and thinking of prices? I mean, are they, is their focus, isn't it more on, gee, I hope they can help me produce this result, more than, gee, I hope they're affordable?
Well, if you're dealing with a real buyer.
Real buyer, right.
A buyer's
Let's
concern.
Let's distinguish that a bit later on. Keep going.
A buyer's concern is to get results.
Right.
If you're dealing with a gatekeeper is rewarded for conserving budget.
Right.
And so that's why I'm constantly a purist about this. You have to deal with a buyer. If a buyer is impressed with your ability to get him or her results, that buyer will find money for you. But a gatekeeper has no ability to find money. Their sole charge in life is to save money.
And they can say no, but not yes, right?
Exactly.
So I'm a person that calls Alan Weiss, you know. Woe to me. Alan's going to handle it well. But and I say, Alan, we've heard about you. We've read your books. We want you to come in. We want to talk. But it turns out that I'm a gatekeeper. What are the kind of things that you ask me off the bat to find out, you know, where I am in this process, and what are the actual things you do to bring in that decision maker?
Well, it's very simple. I mean, first of all, if I don't know
you... It might be simple for you, but I can't tell you how difficult it is for some people, because they don't know how.
I'm just warning everybody, it's simple. So just, if I don't know if you're the buyer,
yep.
I simply ask this question. What is your decision-making process there? And I'll explain my process here.
Okay.
In other words, is this coming out of your budget? Do you make the decision, or are there more people involved? That will tell me if you're the buyer or not. Now, assuming you're not the buyer, which is the example you just gave me,
yep.
Then the question I'm going to ask is this. Well, listen, Michael, Robert, let's use you. Listen, yep. Robert, how do we reach John, the buyer? Because I'm sure, as you can understand, from an ethical standpoint, I have to hear from the person who's making this investment what his or her expectations are. Once I know that, I'm happy to work with you. But I know that you can understand. I need to hear that for myself. And if you say to me, well, gee, no other consultant has asked that, well, then the answer is simple. Well, that's exactly why you need me. I can't believe you would even think about hiring a consultant who doesn't request a meeting with the person who has the fiduciary responsibility.
Right. And you've had that conversation, I assume. And then they say,
Well, they'll say one of a few things. They'll say, Alan, I'm happy to set that up. Just give me a little bit of preliminary information and what does this look like and so forth. However, some of them tell you this, Alan, I'm sorry, I'm tasked. I love that phrase. I'm tasked with finding consultants because my boss is busy and I'm going to make the recommendation and my boss is going to rubber stamp it.
Yeah, and you know this never happened in the history of mankind, right?
Well, even if it does, I'm not interested because meeting the boss, I'll get a larger project. And so I'm going to say, Robert, I understand that's how you work, but it's not the way I work. And frankly, that causes me grave ethical concern. Now, we can do this three ways. You can go to your boss and present what I have, but I'm not going to allow that to happen because it's unfair to have you do my marketing for me.
Mm-hmm.
Two, we can go together as a team. And that way, you know, you can take credit for bringing me in and I can hear what I have to hear. Or three, if you're afraid there might be some kind of repercussion, just introduce me and I'll go by myself. And if there's any flack, you know, you won't be in the line of fire. But that's how it's going to work here.
Great. And if they don't like that, it's no deal, right?
It's no deal with them, but you can still go to the buyer directly. And what I would suggest is you say to the buyer something like this. Listen, Robert contacted me, and he's a great guy, and, you know, had one.
This is assuming you can find out who the buyer is and get through this guy.
Well, you'll be able to find out because if you ask him the question, how's this going to be done, you know.
Yep.
First of all, he's probably going to tell you, my boss, John, does this. But if not, you can find out through the hierarchy who he works for.
Right.
That's not difficult. But what you say is to the boss, you never badmouth anyone. You say, I've been working with Robert, and he's looking. Unfortunately, Robert wants a proposal, and I cannot provide a proposal until I hear some things from you personally. In fact, I can't imagine you'd entertain a proposal from consultants who didn't want to hear some things from you personally because there are some rather grave ethical concerns otherwise. So I'm going to call you Friday at 10 o'clock, and let's talk about a few things, and maybe we can arrange a meeting. If that's not good, give me a better time. And then at Friday at 10, you call, and you say to the boss's secretary, I'm calling as promised.
Great.
Now, you have to have that wherewithal. You know, you have to have the ability to do that.
And for everyone listening, I'm sure people are busily scrambling and writing notes, etc. Alan, the thing I like about you, you're giving actual scripts that people could actually use.
They're in all my books. I mean, you need to give people pragmatics.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you say? When do you say it? How do you say it? Why do you say it? How it works? All of that, you know, I'm totally behind that. We're going to actually have this teleclass transcribed word for word. And in a week or so, everyone in this teleclass will get that transcription. So you'll have that in your hands. Go ahead and make notes, but you're going to have the transcription. Okay, let's get into, you know, obviously we can get into this very, very deep. But I want to look at another area, which is how do you set the stage for being able to charge really high prices in the first place? That is, the whole thing around your personal marketing, your information that you put out there, your value proposition, your website, et cetera, et cetera. What's your take on that, and what do you do to make sure? Well, you know, it's you know, you could say, well, heck, just write 25 books, you get... You get very well known, and that's very true, but not everybody is at a place where they have a book or they're ready to do it on that level. For somebody that's beginning, how do they start to communicate that expertise?
Well, when I started in 1985, I was fired from a company, and you know, I had a large mortgage and kids in private school, and I had very little money in the bank. And so I hadn't written 25 books then. I had written zero books then.
Exactly.
So I'd been there. You know, you're not talking to somebody here who inherited their daddy's business.
No.
You're talking to somebody who did it on his own. And so I know wherever I speak, and I've helped all kinds of other people to do this. So there are several responses to your question. The first is, you're better off doing less things of high quality than more things of low quality. So whatever you decide to do, your letterhead, your brochure, your presentation kit, whatever it is, has to be a very, very high quality, because image is important here. Similarly, excuse me, I recommend that everyone have one $2,000 suit. And I don't care if you'd never wear it except for that key presentation to a key buyer. On your way out, you can change out of it in the restroom. I don't care. But Armani, Canali, Brioni, you need a $2,000 designer suit that's fitted to you and you look great in, because I'll tell you why. Buyers love to be around successful people. And don't believe this garbage that you hear, that you should dumb down your looks, dumb down your language, dumb down your attire. That's from people who haven't made it. You need to look professional and look very good. When you're in front of a buyer, don't pull out a Bic pen. Pull out a Montblanc or a Cartier pen. If you have to, get a knockoff. But pull out something that looks expensive. You want to seem successful. So in line with that, make sure your vocabulary is excellent. Make sure that you can speak well and use the language well, because language controls discussion, discussion controls relationship, and relationship controls the business. So that's the kind of professional image you need to have. Now, on a more pragmatic basis in terms of the things you do, if you're going to have a website, have a professional website, and just have a few pages that look great and add to it as you go, but don't try to have 100 pages that are poorly done. Always get outside help when you need it. I would never design my own website, not in a gazillion years. All the content is mine, but I have professionals design it and maintain it and put it up there and all that.
Yeah, I would underline that 100 times. People have poor-looking websites, and they're probably hurting them more than helping them, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
The same thing with artwork for anything you create, your manuals, your books, your pamphlets, your brochures, whatever it is, your collateral material, get a graphics artist. If you cannot afford a good graphics artist, I'll give you a hint, go to any major university with an art department, and the students in the art department, who will be excellent, will be delighted to work, you know, for $25 an hour or something. So you can always get that level of professional help. Just look a little harder for it. Make sure that what you send out, an email and hard copy and so forth, is correct language and typo-free and things like that. You have to put out an image of success. Now, on a more strategic sense rather than the tactical, you have to be able to stand out in a crowd. You have to create a brand. When I first started in 85, when I was fired, I said to myself, you know, I'm not a socializer. I'm really an introvert. I don't like to network. What am I going to do? And I became the contrarian. I spoke because I love to speak, and I wrote because I love to write. And I just disagreed with everything. I disagreed with these crazy quality people in their cults, and I said, quality doesn't work, you know? And people started to listen to me. A lot of them thought I was nuts, but they started to listen. So you have to be able to stand out in the crowd. You have to be provocative. You can't go around quoting, you know, Peter Block and all these guys who say the same thing all the time. You have to be willing to stand out and say, this is what I believe in. And it doesn't have to be contrarian. It just has to be what you believe in, and you can justify it and make it so. That's what it takes, so that people say there's a brand there. And then you can start to create brands, and ultimately your name becomes the brand.
You know, Alan, a few years ago you launched your Balancing Act newsletter. And by the way, if you go to Alan's website, summitconsulting.com, you should sign up for that newsletter. Everybody, of course, on this call gets my newsletter. Alan sends out a newsletter like clockwork the first of every month. It arrives in your email. You could set your watch to it. He's been doing it for years.
And it's free.
And it's free. And he's got a great collection of articles about business, but also about balancing your life. And not only that, well, as you know, Alan's a pretty bright guy, but he's also one of the funniest writers in the world. I'm reading his newsletter and just cracking up, especially the, what's your section at the end?
Don't read this unless you know me very well, or you'll be needlessly ticked off.
Yeah, right. So he has that section. But I think it's interesting that you've presented button-down business kind of approach in this newsletter. In a way, you let it all hang out. It's professional, but it's really you. So it's authentic. It's coming from yourself, and you really get a sense of who this guy Alan Weiss is. How has that newsletter helped you get business?
Well, it's been a tremendous help. You know, I started it about 7 years ago with 40 names who I felt would not, you know, call the police if I sent them a newsletter. And it's subscription only. I don't never add names arbitrarily. And right now we're passing around 7,500. Now, I know that's very little compared to your newsletter, but for me it's pretty good. And Balancing Act, which I've been able to trademark, has enabled me to talk to people about life balance. And so for people who want to look not just at business but at their lives holistically, they've come to me, and they've come to me for coaching. They've asked me to come in and consult in their organizations. They've purchased my books. And so you create this great community where people can participate in one way or another. And that's part of the options that I talked about earlier, that choice of yeses. So it's also greatly enhanced my brand. And the key is this. It's one thing for someone to say, look, get me a great leadership consultant, and your name happens to be in that hat. But it's far better for them to say, get me Alan Weiss.
Exactly.
That's the ultimate brand.
So, I mean, this is indirectly tied to prices, but if you're a known quantity, if people have heard about you over a period of time, if they've read a couple of your books, you can demand a higher price, and it's not going to come under question as much as someone they've never heard of, correct?
Make no mistake about it. When you reach out to other people, you have to convince them how good you are. When people come to you, they're already convinced how good you are, and price is no longer an issue.
Absolutely. So, Alan, you talk so fast, and we've covered so much in 45 minutes, and we've got a 90-minute teleclass, so I'm going to scramble to have to come up with more questions. But I know I know you have a lot more material, and I have some other stuff I can draw from. Let's go back to some of the
We can always do the first 45 minutes over again.
Yeah, I think some people would like that. Yeah, what did he say? Well, don't worry, you'll get the transcript. And you can also listen to this again because we are recording it. Tell me about some of the technical things about billing and getting paid sooner and accelerating fees, that kind of thing. You know, I learned some of this stuff from Alan, and I used to be in the website design business. And everybody that did website design said, well, a third up front and a third later and a third when you're completed. And I said, well, gee, maybe I could accelerate it. So I asked for two-thirds up front always, and I always got it without an argument. I asked for the last third later because I felt if I'd asked all it up front, I might never finish the website. But tell us a little bit about how how the payments work usually when you work with people.
Well, if it's consulting, I tell them it's 50% on acceptance when they accept my proposal, and it's 50% in 45 days, no matter how long the project is. Now, I also give them a 10% discount if they pay the full fee up front, a courtesy discount. And so my cash flow is tremendous. If I'm speaking, and let's say, you know, I'm doing a $10,000 speech someplace, you just pay the money to hold the date. I don't take a deposit. I don't take 50%. You pay the fee. It holds the date. I would advise anybody who's doing small amounts, like if you're charging $3,500 for coaching or something like that, or let's say a retainer for $3,500 a month, you get the money up front, period. You don't stretch those things out. So the more aggressive you are with your pricing, if you do have to compromise, you're compromising from a very strong position. And this business is about cash flow. For example, you didn't ask me this, Robert, but it comes under this heading. If you're billing for expenses, at the end of a month, you've been working for a month, and you bill expenses at the end of the month as they're accrued. You don't put on there due 30 days net. You put on there due on presentation. That way, if they do take 30 days, okay, on the 31st day, you're on them like the wrath of God. But if you put 30 days net, they'll take 60 days.
Right.
So this is cash flow, and you want to collect everything as quickly as you can. Never accept money on completion of a project. It's crazy.
One thing that I also took note of is if someone has paid you for a project, they're not going to cancel it, right?
Well, they can't cancel it because you're not going to give them their money back.
Right.
And so if
you've spread it out over a year and it's halfway through, well, you know, if they don't pay you the rest.
Well, let's face it, Robert. Yeah. In the best of companies, buyers change, economic conditions change.
Right.
The competition does something. And with the best of intentions, I say, sorry, we have to end your project. Now, if you've already been paid, you say, well, that's fine. Okay, but if you haven't been paid, now all of a sudden you got a problem.
Yeah, so they'll probably say, well, since we've paid you, we might as well continue, right?
Well, they have no choice.
Yeah.
The investments, I mean, it's like you've invested in somebody to take care of the lawn all year and you've paid them. By saying to them, well, stop now, don't take care of the lawn for the rest of the year, you're not saving anything.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, like most things that Alan teaches, it's very common sense, and yet we often miss it entirely. And again, I think it comes back to that self-esteem thing. It's like we give all the power to the buyer and realize that we have much, much more power than we realize in the first place. So here's another question, different area. You've got a client you've been working with for a long time and a new client. Are fees different for new clients versus old clients? Do you give people a sliding rate to any degree? To what kind of subtle adjustments depending on who the clients are? And also then there's the clients, to throw this into the mix, there's what's called the difficult clients. Do you charge them more, and how do you do that?
Well, let's take the first part of your question.
Okay.
I charge based on value. And so it doesn't matter how long you've been with me. I'm going to charge you based on value for what I'm doing at the moment. If the value is less than what it was last year, I'll charge you less. If the value is more, I'll charge you more. And so it's all based on value. Now, if a client says, Alan, we want you to do 8 speeches for us, instead, you know, can you give us a break and not charge us $10,000 a speech? Well, of course I can. If you're going to guarantee the volume. But then I'm going to say, but you pay me in advance. And so instead of $100,000, it's only going to be $85,000, but you have to pay me today, even though the speeches won't be completed for a year. But that's the quid pro quo.
Yep.
Now, the second thing you said, though, is different entirely. Lousy prospects make terrible clients. So there's nothing wrong with charging a premium for certain kinds of work. For example...
Well, define a lousy prospect to begin with. How do you know they're going to be a lousy prospect?
Well, a lousy prospect is someone who doesn't keep appointments, who cancels things at the last minute, who changes his or her mind, who vacillates, who might use language or references that you don't think are appropriate, who doesn't treat people well. I mean, these people become terrible clients. They don't improve.
People that string you along forever, never give you a definite answer.
Yeah, I mean, there are buyers like that.
Yes.
Now, there's also clients, though, that are difficult for other reasons, Robert. There are clients, for example, who are far afield. So if I work in the Pacific Rim, I double any kind of fee I would come up with otherwise. If I work in Europe or Latin America, I increase by 50% because there's so much more travel. You have to acclimate. You have to prepare different culturally and so forth. Then there are clients who are difficult because they might just require a lot of travel, period, even if you're, you know, in the same country. There are clients who are difficult because you have to create a lot of new models, or you have to deal with a union, or you have to deal with, you know, their own suppliers or customers or whatever. And for that, you should charge a premium. But if a client is difficult because the buyer is not pleasant, my advice is don't take the business. Because the only thing worse than no business is bad business, because bad business causes you to defocus completely, and you actually lose traction elsewhere.
Exactly.
I also tell people that every 2 years they should drop about the bottom 15% of their business, because you cannot reach out unless you let go. And if you're carrying this baggage, you know, clients you've been dealing with for 8 years, and you know they're paying you $750 or something, you know, this has to be a humane kind of killing here. You have to
humane killing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just the best. You have to refer them elsewhere.
After all, you've been working with them a long time. You like them, you've helped them, but you just can't afford to carry them.
Well,
you
treat them like, you know, you treat them like some kind of loyal pet, but they're not a pet because pets don't pay you. You know, pets hang around and they give you their goodwill. But these people are supposed to be paying you. And so you got to say, look, I can't afford anymore to give you the attention which you deserve.
Yeah.
And I'm not asking you for more money. I would never do that. I want to refer you to someone else. But if you don't lighten that load, you can't reach out anymore, and you find yourself weighed down by low-profit clients.
Right, and you can't expand out into the next level because all your time is taken up.
Yeah, I mean, this is a business. It's not about being loved. If you want to be loved, get a dog. But this is a business.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean your clients can't love you. I'm sure a lot of your clients just love the heck out of you.
No.
Nah, they hate you?
It's a business relationship, you know?
Yeah. I admit to getting caught up emotionally with my clients. I mean, I just love working with them. You know, when they're gone, I miss them, etc. But it's true. You know, I still charge them the fees, and they've got to pay, and on from there. Okay, another question for you. I want to get more into proposals. Now, in my manual, I wrote a manual on marketing. I have borrowed rather liberally from your outline of proposals, and I've given you credit. I'm probably responsible for more sales of $1 million consulting than any single person. Don't ask me to account for that, Alan, but I've definitely referred a lot of people to your site and to your book. But one of the most useful parts in that book is the whole proposal outline. And someone read that proposal outline in my manual, and a couple weeks later came back and said, I just got a $300,000 project because of that proposal outline. He said, I hadn't even read the rest of your manual. So if you don't listen to any other part of the talk, listen to this. Can we sort of break down the sections of a proposal and when to give a proposal and when not to give a proposal, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I've written an entire book on proposals called How to Write a Proposal That's Accepted Every Time.
Yep.
And so there's,
I have it.
I've got a complete book on that. But it basically, it looks like this. You don't submit a proposal until you have conceptual agreement with the buyer, meaning you have agreement on objectives, measures, and value, the kinds of stuff we talked about earlier. A proposal is never an exploration. It's a summation of conceptual agreement. It's not a negotiating document. A proposal has 9 parts to it. The first is it's about 2.5 pages. No matter what the size of the project, doesn't matter. It's about 2.5 pages.
Yeah, you'd think with giant projects, you'd write a book, but au contraire, it's shortened to the point.
Yeah. And so the first part is what I call situation appraisal. It's a paragraph or two on why you're talking. You've got attrition problems, you've got retention problems, you have market share problems, or you want to improve your operation and expand into the Northeast, or you want to improve your technology and do X, Y, or Z. That's the situation appraisal. The second part is the objectives, and I usually do these with bullet points. Here are the objectives to be obtained, and there are never more than, you know, 6 or so objectives, because otherwise that gets nuts.
Yep.
Step number 3 are the metrics, which I talked about earlier. Here's the measurement. Bullet points again. Step number 4 is value. Here's what it's worth to your organization. Bullet points again. So steps 2, 3, and 4 are simply conceptual agreement. Step number 5 would be methodology and options. And here's where you put the 2, 3, 4 options that you're going to say to the client. We can do it 1 of 4 ways. You pick what's best for you. No fees, just the methodology and the options. Step number, what am I up to? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 is timing. What's the probable duration of the project in each of those options? Not calendar dates, but just 30 days, 6 months, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Next is joint accountabilities, which means that the client's responsible for certain things and you're responsible for certain things, and then you're both responsible for certain things. That shows that this is a true partnership. It's not just something one person does to the other. Next, we have my favorite part, which is terms and conditions. And this is the first part, the first time the buyer sees the terms and conditions. And so this is the first time the fees appear. And you say the fee for option 1 is this, the fee for option 2 is this, the fee for option 3 is this. Here are the payment terms, 50% on acceptance. And here's how I bill expenses, you know. And I bill these kinds of expenses, hotel and travel and this. I don't bill this. I don't bill duplication or FedEx or phone charges or stupid things. Next would be acceptance. And the acceptance says, choose the option you want, and your signature indicates acceptance of the terms above. And that's it.
I notice you don't put a lot of legalities into it.
Zero legalities, because if you put legalities in, it goes to the client's legal department, and you want to stay way far away from the legal department, because lawyers, especially employed by organizations, are archly conservative. They feel that if anything new happens, it's dangerous. And so the ideal corporate attorney will tell you that he or she would prefer that you don't open the doors in the morning, don't turn the lights on, don't turn the heat on. In fact, don't even have employees come in, because then you can't get hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how these people are.
Yeah, they're controlling the business in many cases, and they're hurting it at the same time.
Well, I mean, if they were really good attorneys, they'd be out on their own making $400,000, but they're not. They're making $80,000 working in the corporate world. So you want to stay away from these people. And you do that by avoiding boilerplate. I've actually had a client send me $225,000 checks. It was a $250,000 project. They sent me $100,250 on acceptance and $100,250 in 45 days. And the project lasted 4 months, and I never did get a signed proposal. And the reason is the executive vice president could authorize a $125,000 check, but could not sign a contract without sending it through the legal department, and he knew what would happen as well as I did, so he just never signed it. That's fine with me.
But, you know, you could take him at his word, and, you know, he sent you the check, so you're off and running, right?
Well, in fact, as I learned from that, I now have a sentence in there that says, in effect, your check is as good as your signature. And what I say is, alternatively, the acceptance of your deposit indicates your acceptance also of all the terms stipulated herein.
Uh-huh. So that's about as legal as it gets.
Well, yeah, that's not a legal phrase, but I've never, ever had trouble with this stuff, ever.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the delivery of the proposal and a little bit more detail on when you say, okay, is this how it goes? I understand what you want, your metrics, your value, et cetera. What I'm going to do is put a proposal together for you. I'll get it to you, da-da-da. Do you try to deliver the proposal in person, or is that usually not?
Never.
You just can't do that, right?
Well, if you do it, what happens is the client says, let me have a chance to look through it. And, you know, I've just seen this for the first time. I'm not in a position to – it's just stupid. It's a waste of time. What you want to do is you want to FedEx – always FedEx.
FedEx.
Hard copy to the buyer. Now, some buyers will say, send me an electronic copy. I prefer it. And if that's the case, then do what they ask. Send them an electronic copy, probably as an attachment with a Word document, which will retain formatting.
Right.
But also send them a hard copy backup via FedEx. And what you tell the client is, I mean, throughout consulting and coaching and facilitating and training and all this stuff, you should always have a next step at every stage of the game. And so what you want to say is, I'm FedExing this proposal on Tuesday. You will get it on Wednesday. I'm going to call you on Friday. And that way, you put the client on notice that you're going to be calling. You get the client to say, yes, I will be in on Friday. 10 o'clock is fine, because don't forget, you have a good relationship. No reason for the buyer to try to avoid you. And so you FedEx this thing, and you call them Friday at 10. That's how you close on a proposal, because the longer you take with the proposal, the longer it takes the client to get back to you, the more bad things happen.
Yes.
Nobody ever said, you know, Alan, I'm glad this took an extra month. I was able to raise an extra $200,000. That never, ever happens.
So the faster the better. One thing that I hear a lot from people is, well, I put together the proposal, I sent it off, and now they won't return my calls. What did they do wrong?
Well, there's one of three or four things that they did wrong, and that is very common. Number one is, it might not have been a real economic buyer.
Mm-hmm.
Either you missed it or they lied to you.
Yep.
Number two, it's an economic buyer, but you didn't get conceptual agreement. So they just said, send me the proposal so it'll get you out of the office. But you never really tested for conceptual agreement. Number three is, you haven't really shown in your proposal, it is an economic buyer, you did have conceptual agreement, but you really haven't demonstrated in the proposal that there's a significant return on investment. You didn't write it very well. You didn't write it very compellingly. And so it's usually one of those three things.
Good. So fix those, and it's going to be a whole different response.
Fix those, and you'll hit 80%. And if you hit 80% of your proposals, and you're sending out a decent amount of proposals, I mean, even just three a month, you're gonna be a wealthy person.
Now, if you're a coach and you're not doing this kind of level of things, but you're, well, it could be a personal coach, it could be executive coach, it could be from, you know, a few hundred to a few thousand dollars a month. Would you recommend a proposal for that or just a verbal agreement?
No, I'd recommend a proposal because I'd recommend you change your entire business model. There was an article in yesterday's...
Okay, let's get into that.
Well, there was an article in yesterday's New York Times about life coaches.
Yep.
And they're dealing with, you know, major Hollywood celebrities, and they're dealing with major corporate CEOs. In fact, today the cachet is to have a personal coach.
Yeah.
And so I would suggest that you capitalize on that. And the fact is that your business model has to be that you work backwards, you find out what this person needs for improvement. I mean, look, let's take a small business. I mean, take a business that's a few million dollars, and it's run by the owner, and it's a family business, okay, the worst kind of circumstance in the world. But you make contact through, you know, one means or another with the owner, and she's a person who is proud of what she's done and has developed a $5 million business. But you find out what her objectives are. You find out where she wants to go, whether she wants to build it to a $40 million business and sell it, or personally, she wants to be known as one of the key go-to persons in her particular field, or she wants to branch out into new areas and add different divisions to the business, or she wants to become more efficient and have fewer people do more. Who knows? But you find out what that is. You get the value stipulated for what that will be for her. And you do a proposal that reflects that. And so instead of this $1,500 a month, whatever you're talking about, now you've got a $25,000 project.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now you're positioning as $1,500. Heck, that's nothing.
Listen,
yeah.
my mechanic gets $125 an hour or something.
Yeah.
You know, $100,000 isn't what it used to be.
True.
You know, I'm serious here.
Yeah.
And so if you want to support a family, if you want to lead a decent lifestyle, and by decent lifestyle I mean you're not constantly on airplanes, you're taking vacations before you schedule business, you're taking care of your loved ones, you're contributing to philanthropy. If you want to lead a decent lifestyle and you're an independent professional, you're a consultant or a coach, or you're in accounting, you're in law, whatever, you've got to make at least $200,000 or more a year. And if you're not doing that, you're kidding around.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. When I passed that level and went way past that level, life changed quite a bit.
You're able to do more for others.
You're just not worried about money most of the time. If you really need to buy something that you can. Doesn't mean you have to, you know, you can take care of your retirement. I mean, gosh, there's so many reasons to really take this stuff to heart.
Robert, if you and I were concerned that we weren't making enough money, neither of us would be spending 90 minutes on this call in the middle of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I do think I have, I have one or two more questions, and then, you know, I think we're going to have time and we can open it up to, from questions from the audience.
I just have to be gone at 2:30, that's all. And it's now 2 o'clock where I am.
No problem. You have a little chapter in your book on maximizing fees on focusing on innovation, not fixing, which really looks at the value pricing thing even deeper. What do you mean by that?
There's a fundamental difference between fixing something, which means restoring something to prior performance, whether it's a person's performance or a piece of equipment or a process, and taking something that's performing well and raising the bar. Fixing things is usually done internally. It's a commodity. They have quality teams. They have task forces. And it's not looked on as anything dramatic because you're fixing something so that it performs the way it used to.
Yeah.
But when you raise the bar, now you're outstepping the competition. Now you're creating new standards. Now you're creating new sources of income or improvement or whatever it is. And so the great companies, you know, the Hewlett-Packards and the Johnson & Johnsons and the FedExes and the Microsofts and the Sonys and the Toyotas, the great companies look to constantly raise their own bar because they don't have the competition pressing them, so they have to raise the bar themselves. It's the lousy organizations. It's almost every airline in existence, you know, with the exception of maybe Southwest and Continental, and I'm not too sure about them anymore. It's every airline in the world that's constantly trying to fix things because there's something about airline management, there's something about airlines that attract every stupid manager in the world. I mean, I have never seen the degree of stupidity, the degree of low IQ in management as I see in the airlines. And so they're constantly fixing things because they're constantly tripping over themselves. So innovation and raising the bar is where the value is, not just repairing things.
People often call you because they've got a problem and they want it fixed. And they go into the conversation with, can you fix this? Isn't that the case?
Ah, but here is the crux of that.
Yes.
Most people know what they want. They don't know what they need.
Yes, let's get into that.
Well, the key for a consultant, for anyone listening to this conversation, is to take what a client wants as opening the door. And when you get in the door, help them understand what they need. The difference between what they think they want and what they really need is what I call your value distance. And the greater that distance, the more you can charge. If it's just a little hop, you can't charge very much. But when somebody says, well, we want a sales program, the first thing you say is, why? You don't say, oh, yes, I got a great sales program, 3 days, $7,500.
Yep.
You say, why? And they say, well, we need to improve sales. Why? Well, because we've got 25% attrition. Really? You're losing 25% of your customers. Yeah. Why? We don't know. Well, would it help to find out? So don't just accept what a customer wants, because now you're a commodity and they're comparing your price against other people who are bidding for it.
Yeah.
Raise the client beyond that.
To look at a more prosaic example, people used to call me from the Yellow Pages and say, I want a brochure. And I said, well, what I do is I help professionals who are struggling to attract clients and want more clients. Is that what you're looking for? And they said, no, we just want a brochure and the best price. Obviously, it really couldn't go anywhere, so it's a similar kind of conversation. You're trying to find out, you're trying to promote something way beyond what they think they want.
Let me give you two quick examples.
Great.
Years and years ago, when Kodak was still well run, people thought they wanted photos. What Kodak says, no, you don't want photos. What you need are memories. Now, if you want photos, you're going to compare Kodak's price to Fujifilm, and Kodak would lose that every time based on the labor costs.
Right.
But when Kodak says, we're talking about memories, and who do you want to trust here? Because you're talking about your wedding or your anniversary or your grandchild's birth. Well, then there's no question. You pay whatever you pay. You know, nobody wants the cheapest heart surgeon. The other comes from the 50s, where three words doubled the sales of the shampoo industry. When somebody in the bowels of the marketing department of Procter & Gamble or somewhere decided that they should put on the label, rinse and repeat. You don't have to rinse and repeat. Nobody's hair is so dirty, you have to shampoo it twice, but people follow instructions. And so they think, well, I want to
double the shampoo.
Double the shampoo with no capital investment, no added product, not an iota of change except three words. I mean, think about that profit. And what happened was people said, well, I want to take a shampoo. Oh, but apparently I need to rinse and repeat. Most people still do.
Yeah. So we've covered a heck of a lot of stuff. What have I left out here? You know, say this is the last conversation I'll ever have with you, and I've got to know everything and take notes. What are any other strategies, principles, ideas that are so important that it would be a shame to leave them out?
Well, listen, I mean, I've written 25 books, so
yeah.
I've spoken to...
I know, but they all haven't been about value pricing, so we're focusing on that.
And I've spoken to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, but if this were our last conversation,
yeah.
I mean, let me take you at your word. I would say this to you. Don't ever forget that your work is fuel for your life. Never the other way around. And consequently, just as I said before, you have to work backwards with a client, you have to work backwards with yourself. You have to say, what are my life goals? What do I want to achieve for myself, for my loved ones, for society? And then what's the economic engine I need to support that?
Right.
That's what determines what your business looks like.
Not how much money could I make.
Exactly.
Yes.
I mean, if I started by saying, I want to make this much money a year, I'd never be making what I am today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the problem with a business plan is that you hit it. So you always work backwards from what you want to achieve. And that way, you have some perspective, and you don't get involved with trying to do something for $1,500 a month.
Right. Well, you're really stretching people's boundaries of thinking about this, which is what you always do, which I definitely appreciate. So we're going to see if some people on the call have questions or clarification. So,
or if anybody's still on the line.
I'm sure there are. Okay,
Alan?
The line is open. Who has a question for Alan?
Alan, I have a question. You didn't cover point number three, ability to reach these top people.
Okay,
at the very start, you said there were three areas. Could you cover the third a little bit more? How do we get into that C-level suite?
Yeah, okay, that's a great question. Okay, if I do that, Robert?
Yeah, and I'm going to try to keep this line open, so try to keep it quiet in the background.
And I'll try to be brief.
Go ahead.
Okay, the way you reach these people, preferably, is to be a person of interest, to be an object of interest. That means that nobody will accept a cold call. If you have to put yourself in their shoes. I mean, when somebody calls me at 8:30 at night and says, listen, you've been selected to buy $40,000 of oil futures in Kazakhstan, I hang up. People don't buy that way. They won't buy from someone they don't know. So don't cold call. What you should do is create an object of interest. Now, depending upon your comfort level and your comfort zones, that means you ought to be publishing in things that they read. You ought to be speaking at events that they attend. You ought to be networking with people they know or at events where they are. You ought to be doing pro bono work on associations and task forces and nonprofits where they themselves might be doing that. You need to be creating a product that they might utilize. If you know the buyer, you know what they read, you know where they go, you know what they think about, try to apply yourself to them in every sensory way so that you become an item of interest. The platinum rule here is a buyer-to-buyer reference, and the gold rule is a commercially published book.
So it sounds like you're preaching InfoGuru marketing, as I've outlined in my manual. I mean, it's about being out there, being known, being slightly famous. And Alan has definitely accomplished that. Do you ever suggest, say you find out about a company, you hear about a company, you see they have a problem. I'm sure you don't do that now. You don't need to. But in the earlier stages of business, you have no work. You don't have a lot of visibility yet. You've got to get some work. Are there any conditions under which you would suggest reaching out to a potential client, and how would you do that?
Well, yes, but what you have to do is find a way to make a cold call lukewarm.
Yes.
So let's suppose that the Acme company is, you know, 30 minutes away. They seem to have needs that fit your competencies. You think you'd be ideal for them. In that case, find out who your likely buyer is, call the switchboard, do a Google, you know, read some background, and then see if you can find someone to introduce you. See if you can be in an event where they will be. See if you can do something to create some recognition so that you're not making a cold call. In worst case, send them something that's right on target for their needs and say, I was thinking of you, I read about what you're going through, here's some value, you know, give them a checklist or a book or something. I'm going to call you Friday at 10 o'clock to see how you like it. But that's worst case. Try to make it lukewarm before you do that.
Great, very good. Okay, let's have another question.
Hey, I have a question. If you have established what they want, you help them understand what they need, you put a value on that. I assume you do that together, you talk about that?
That's correct.
Then how do you then, as far as your pricing, do you say, well, this is the value for you, let's say it's $50,000 for me to take you from point A to point B. Then do you price that? Do you take a percentage of that? Or how do you, what's the bridge here?
That's fine. That's a good question. But let me just correct something. It's not $50,000 for you to take them from point A to point B. It's $50,000 of improvement they're going to have through one way or another, to use your example here. But what I like to look at is at least a 10-to-1 return. I like to see that a client can easily see at least a 10-to-1 return. And don't forget, I'm providing, you know, 3 or 4 options here. That means it's incumbent upon you not just to settle for a few sentences, but to really plumb the depths with the client to get a handle on everything that's going to amount to improvement, not just sales, but also employee morale or retention of talent or whatever it is,
right,
so that you have a full view of that. Mm-hmm. Then you have a higher value, you can assign a higher fee and still see 10-to-1 or better.
So if it's $1 million of improvement, you're worth $100,000.
At least. I mean, you can go up from there. But at least, you know, I have a manufacturing consulting firm that's a client. And when they work with their clients, they try to get a 3 or 4 to 1 return. So a 10 to 1 return, virtually nobody sees these days. If you can demonstrate that in a proposal and somebody says to you, we have no money, I'm going to say, listen, it's worth borrowing money to get a 10 to 1 return. How can you not do that?
How do you associate with improvement in employee morale and some of the more intangibles?
When you say how do I associate with it, do you mean how do I measure it?
And assign value to it.
Yeah.
Well, you ask the client. Never take this on yourself. You say, what would reflect improvement in morale here? And it's usually things, the client will say things like, well, employee grievances would go down. Our turnover would go down. We'd have increased membership in the blood drive and other voluntary things we try to do. We'd have more voluntary overtime, and we wouldn't have to mandate it, and so forth and so on. And then you say, well, what would a decrease in employee grievances, for example, mean for you? What do you spend on it now every year? What would it mean by retaining top talent? What's your turnover right now in middle management? You know, it costs about $60,000 every time you turn someone over in middle management. And that's the discussion you have interactively with the client. And you'll arrive at some things, and then you'll summarize it and say, you know, do we agree on this? That's conceptual agreement.
How do you put a value on an increase in reputation?
Well, I would say to you something like this. If your repute were improved, there must be some reason you want to do that. Are you looking to get clients or customers from increased sources? In other words, what would it mean to you if your value, your image, your repute was increased so much that suddenly word of mouth sent people to you? Well, what it means is for every increased sale you got, there'd be no cost of acquisition. It would mean that people would be doing your advertising for you. It would mean that you'd be getting free coverage in the newspapers. Tell me something. If that were even a 1% improvement in sales at no cost of acquisition, what would that mean to your operation? That's the kind of dialogue you have.
So you're trying to get to that bottom line, to the real value, and you're not stopping until you find that.
And you're getting the buyer to stipulate.
But how do you do that in a personal sense for us life coaches out there? I can see how you can get to the bottom line in a corporate sense, but what about for...
Right, they're not a business customer or client. They're a personal client. They want to achieve their goals. They want to lose weight. They want to various things, but it's really not so much financial.
It's the exact same process. What you say to someone is, if you lost the weight that you want to lose, that's your objective, what would that enable you to do that you can't do today? What would that where would that enable you to go? What would that enable you to experience that you can't do today? And you talk through that. And somebody says, well, my self-esteem would be improved and I'd be able to get a higher paying job. Or I'd be able to relate better to my children because I'd set a better example for them. Or my colleagues at work would accept me in a better fashion, in a better light, and I'd be more prone to get promotions. Whatever it is, my stress would be decreased. Well, if your stress is decreased, what would that mean for your health? You can't put a price on health.
You bring up an interesting thing, Alan. When you get to these bottom line objectives and values and metrics, etc., don't you find that the potential client becomes much more motivated to work with you when you start to create that future for them?
Yeah, because the future becomes suddenly delineated. It's no longer this ambiguous thing out there. You see, get back to something you said at the very beginning. Most consultants quote a clear price and have very unclear benefits. And so you have this fixed price and you don't know what the benefits are. I'm espousing just the opposite, where you have very clear benefits. And the client and the customer, the client sees that, and almost any investment is going to show a great return for those clear benefits. But it's incumbent upon us to pursue that. And too often we're lax, or we're slothful, or we're reluctant, or for any reason, we don't ask, how will this improve your condition?
Alan, I have a question, kind of turning this in reverse. How do you use this approach when you're determining what you will pay for services you receive from others? For example, somebody that helps you get that first book commercially published, or somebody that's referring a client that you hadn't been able to reach yourself.
Well, we ask you different questions. for subcontractors, for people I contract out to, I tell them never to read my books. And what happens is they say, well, you know, I'm $50 an hour. And I say, well, God, that's a lot of money, but okay. You know, give me a cap on the hours. And so that's how most people price themselves, and that's fine. The second thing you asked me, though, I think, was how do you pay people to refer you to a client? And my feeling is this. If people give you the name of a buyer and you ultimately make the sale, I'll give them 5 to 10% because they gave you the name. If somebody introduces you to a buyer through their goodwill, then it's more like 10 to 15%. And if somebody actually makes the sale for you, that is, they've told the buyer you're the best thing since cold beer, and you just have to go in and not louse it up, then I'll pay 15 or 20%. Those are my referral rates if somebody demands it. In my business, most times people give me names. It's a win-win-win, and they're just doing it as a courtesy, and I reciprocate. But if people do want financial consideration, I think that should be the formula.
Do you have a written agreement for that, Alan?
No. That's no. Right. I just tell people just like I did right there.
Just verbal?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good.
I have another question, if I might.
Go ahead. We have time for a few more.
What I've heard from other people that it's better to give a proposal in person rather than to mail it or FedEx it. What is your opinion on that?
Well, I was asked that before by Robert. You don't do that. It's stupid. Because if you give it to them in person, they won't have time to have read it, and they're going to say, I need more time to look this over. And
right.
They're going to feel under pressure with you sitting there. If you really have conceptual agreement before you write the proposal, you FedEx it to them, and you tell them, I'm going to call you Friday, and we can decide which option you prefer. That's how you do it. It is of no advantage to present a proposal personally unless you don't have a relationship with this person and you feel you have to explain things in the proposal.
And it all comes back to the proposal is not an exploration, it's a summation. You've pretty much agreed that you will work together. You like what Alan has to say. You love the value and the metrics, et cetera, et cetera. And you're ready to go. The only thing that's not there is just the finalizing it and the price tag, right?
That's right.
Okay. So
Alan,
don't propose too soon. Go ahead.
Alan, in the case where you've submitted the proposal, you have a couple options. They're all value priced. And you mentioned earlier some of your prices might be, you might spell out a time frame. How do you counter a potential objection that you might get back where someone says, well, you said you'd do this in 6 months at this price. Now, my calculations, that goes to X amount of hours, dollars per day or per hour. How do you avoid them taking you down the road of making it based on your hour or day rate?
Well, I simply say the following. Well, first of all, I don't have an hour or day rate. What I say is,
okay.
Well, you just divided, and that's fine, but it's got nothing to do with what I've charged you. For example,
okay.
If this has to go an extra month, it will go an extra month, and there'll be no extra charge. If we reach our objectives a month shy, you know, a month faster, the charge will be the same too. And actually, the faster we meet this, the better off you are, right? So it's got nothing to do with time. You can divide all day long, but that's not how I arrived at this. And if somebody says, how did you arrive at it, I say the following thing. My fees reflect my contribution to the value you achieve in this proposal so that you have a great return on investment and I am equitably compensated. That's how partners work together.
That sounds great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's hard to argue with.
I said before, Robert, language controls discussion. Discussion
yep.
controls relationship. Relationship controls business. If you can master the language and know what you want to say, you will win most of the time.
Alan, I have a question.
Very good.
Alan?
Yeah?
Hi. Question. Taking you back to your point about making things lukewarm before you approach a C-level buyer, what are some of the other ways, especially if you're starting out? For example, I've been consulting for a long time, but foolishly haven't created much notoriety, if you will, with people who I haven't worked with. What are some of the ways you could make this lukewarm? How about mail, but that refers people to some papers you've written or to a website or something like that?
Well, all that works. Did you say before, though, you've worked with a lot of people before and you're concerned with how to approach new people?
Yep.
Yes.
Well, go to everyone you've worked with before and get testimonials from them. Get referrals from them. Ask them for names.
I have great testimonials, but few referrals because I haven't asked for them, I guess.
Well, you have to ask for them. You have to, and one thing consultants are terrible at is asking for referrals, yet this is the perfect referral business. It's a win-win-win. If I refer you elsewhere, I win because I helped a partner. The partner wins because you helped them, and you win because you have more business. And so consultants should ask all of their contacts, not just clients, but all of their contacts quarterly, for referrals. There's nothing wrong with that.
How powerful do you think testimonials are from CEOs when read by other CEOs?
Well, extraordinarily powerful, as long as they're attributed. As long as there's a name and a company.
Of course,
they're,
yeah.
They're extraordinarily powerful, because that goes back to what I said before. There's nothing better than a buyer-to-buyer reference.
Okay, good. When, you would consider that a reference as well, not just, you know, I call you and say, well, you know, Robert's great, Alan, hire him.
The best thing is for you to call. But in place of that, if you can't get the call, having that testimonial is very powerful. That testimonial should be on your website. It should be in your press kit. It should be part of all your mailings.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Alan, when I attended a seminar with you several years ago, you pulled out a bound book of testimonials. I mean, it was an inch and a half thick, I think.
Yeah, it's right here in my credenza. I'm looking at it.
Now, and you said, well, I print up, you know, I have the masters of these, and I print up a bunch of them, and I put a cover on it. And then when I meet with a client, I give that to them. And do you still do that, and how do you do that?
When I have an inquiry from a legitimate buyer, a prospect who's a legitimate buyer, and they want to see something, I send them a very expensive press kit. I send them a press kit with an embossed cover. I send them a four-color die-cut brochure in there. It's about 12 pages. I send them my product brochure, and I send them about, 8 or 12 interviews, reprints, things I've done, you know, articles and white papers and so on. And I accompany that with this bound book of testimonials that go back 20 years to show I've been doing great work over two decades. And I'll put in one of my books or CDs or something else for free to show them again that I'm commercially published. And that's what'll go out. And I don't follow up, because if that's not good enough to make them want to meet me, then nothing I do following up will make a difference.
So they will usually get that and then call you and say, I got all your stuff and can we talk?
When can we meet? That's right.
Yeah. So send them the best stuff you have. If you've got a number of articles, if you've got a great brochure.
Like I said, make sure the quality is excellent, and make sure you're dealing with a buyer. And if those two conditions obtain, then you're in business.
Yep.
Alan, question about books. If I'm to write a book, is there any particular kind of book that's preferred? I mean, is it sort of a here's how you do stuff, or clever observations about stuff?
If you want to write a book for credibility in the marketplace with people who might hire you, number one, it has to be commercially published. It cannot be self-published. Mm. Number two, it should be a book that somehow reflects your value proposition. So if you're an expert on leadership, it should be on leadership. If you're an expert on team building, it should be on team building. The content of the book should be provocative. It should give people pragmatic tools to use. You can include in there mini interviews, you can include self-tests. I mean, there's all kinds of devices you can include. But again, put yourself in the shoes of the buyer, and in this case, the reader. After I'm done with the book, how am I better off? Make sure that I get a lot of value out of that, so I'm prone to call you.
Is there any of your books you would recommend as a good template for this?
Million Dollar Consulting.
Well, it depends what your objectives are. But Million Dollar Consulting has been on the shelves since 1992. It's in its third edition, and it's still in the top 1% on Amazon. I mean, by any definition, that is a classic bestseller. Getting Started in Consulting is another one of my books. It's done extraordinarily well for the same reasons. And that's in its second edition. So you write for the particular market that you want to appeal to.
Alan, we've got to wrap up. So with that, Alan, thank you very much for an extraordinarily enlightening 90 minutes. We covered a lot of stuff. It was extremely valuable. Thank you very much.
Robert, always my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.